Accession number 22346, Reel 2.
Captain Riggs, Reel 2.
You were saying there was a sergeant whom you could not promote because...
Yes, I think he was just
illiterate.
About the end of the tape there.
Yeah.
But this was why. He was pretty well illiterate. Mm. And he'd have made a most marvellous company sergeant major. Or a not a CQMS, because they need to have to write and read.
Yes.
But he was a wonderful man, and he was with us for most of World War II, and an absolutely marvellous guy in... when we ran into troubles of various kinds. But he wasn't in my company most of the time. So, but that was the sort of guys that we had, that we encountered when we got to a regular battalion.
Was your platoon up to strength?
Oh. No, I don't think so. I don't think any of the units up there were up to strength, and that's why they were continually shipping out reinforcements at that time, because some more followed us later on. I couldn't put figures on it, but platoons were sort of 20 men when they should have been 30, that sort of thing. Guys were still being repatriated at that stage as well, some of the regulars which had done their seven years, and five on the reserve, as the old sort of India tour that had to be done. And so, no, we weren't up to strength. And indeed, we had guys away on detachments, on courses and that sort of thing. So those who were physically there were probably down to about three-quarters of the nominal strength of a battalion at that time.
What weapons and equipment did you have?
Well, we had the Lee Enfield rifle, of course, was the basic thing. I don't think we had any mortars at the time, not two-inch mortars. I think they came a bit later on. And I think we had some Lewis guns. In fact, I know we did, because we didn't get rid of those and get Bren guns until quite a bit later on. And that was about all. We had nothing else in the way of heavier armament in the battalion. We were more or less all right for vehicles, I think. But by that time, they were beginning to denude Palestine because they knew, presumably, that they were going to have to start up things in the Western Desert. The first wave all, what was known as the first wave all offensive, was in prospect. For the planners anyway. Of course, we didn't know anything about it. We were thoroughly ignorant throughout the whole war of what was being thought about, of course. As you can imagine, there was no radio. The newspapers were hopeless. Censorship was very, very tight indeed. We had no idea, really, what was going on in the UK, except for snippets we got in newspapers after a long time.
When you went on your patrols to visit villages, did those go out in vehicles, or were they on foot?
No, it was on foot, because many of them were not accessible to vehicles anyway. We tended not to go to the town so much, because the Palestine police were stationed in many of those places. But we go up all around the villages, all up in the Judean hills, and where they still just had a few goats and a few bits of stone buildings and wooden ploughs and an olive tree or two, and that was the way they'd been living for thousands of years. That was very entertaining, if you like, for a youngster who'd just come out from England. Of course, it was interesting to see, what the sort of biblical setting was like. Because I'd been to a choir school, as a matter of fact, as a boy, as a youngster.
Read your Bible.
Well, I used to hear a lot of it, yes. And so to see a bit of how the Old Testament, the context of the Old Testament, we had Jacob's Well just down the road at Nablus, of course. So lots of it was extremely interesting. As I say, it was quiet, the country at the time, and so it wasn't too difficult to move about in it occasionally. If you get into a vehicle, you could go off to Nazareth and hither and thither and all these places, the biblical sites.
When you did do such a visiting patrol, as it were, what strength would you go out in?
Usually a section and two, because we always had a lot of guys on guard everywhere, which was a hangover from the Arab rebellion time. And you had an emergency platoon which was ready, you know, on standby in case there was a... It was very ambushable, the roads around there, from sniping and what have you, and very rocky country. You've been there, been to Israel, have you? No. But, so it was... travelling during the Troubles, if I could call them that, travelling by road was really quite difficult. In fact, they had roads which are designated as two-track roads, three-track roads, four-track roads, where you had to have a machine gun or something at the front and the back vehicles, you know, as convoying. But luckily, all that had gone. When I joined the battalion, it had suddenly gone all quiet. And in fact, at one stage, there was only ourselves and a battalion of the bus at Haifa, in Acre Barracks up there. Were the only infantry units, complete infantry units, in the whole of Palestine later on.
Did you get any sense of the political atmosphere while you were there?
No, not really. There was nothing like there is today in Israel, of course. You see, the Jewish settlements were all down on the coastal plain, mainly, which was the more fertile part of the country. And as soon as you started to go up into the hills, it was entirely Arab. I shall mention again a bit later on. So they were almost completely separated. There were some Jewish quarters in Jerusalem, of course, but not in Nablus. Was probably the biggest of the Arab towns, but it was all Arab. Holy Arab town at that time, Palestinian Arabs, and so there was no, there wasn't much close contact between the Jews and the Arabs, so there wasn't today's kind of politics there at all at that time, and not much agitation for freedom or liberation or whatever. Not until much later, but luckily I was not in Palestine in 1945, which was a rotten time for the British Army.
What impression did you get of the Palestine police?
Not much, you know. They used to come and have a beer with us, and we used to go and have a beer with them. We got on very well with them. They didn't regard us as treading on their territory or anything like that. There was no need for protocol when we met up with them. We used to play rugby with them when up in Jerusalem occasionally and things like that, until we were banned because the ground was so stony that we were all getting septic rashes. Every first time you fell over, you took all the skin off your elbows and knees, and so very soon the doctors banned us from playing rugby, and haven't played rugby since, actually. And never will, of course. But no, we got on very well with them, and you know, they were good guys. There was usually a sort of junior officer, and who was British, of course, and quite a lot of Northern Ireland guys, as there were in the Hong Kong police that I met later on, and many of them went into the colonial police forces all over the place.
What could you do when you were off duty? What were the leisure facilities were in Nablus?
Well, we had a football pitch there and that sort of thing, you know, and we'd play football against the other units. We even played, in some parts of the country, there was even, you could play cricket on mats, you know, and that sort of thing. And we did that. There was no swimming. Occasionally, if we were lucky and got to get a Sunday off, we could drive down to the coast of Jaffa and we'd swim. Because again, it was possible to move around the roads without being intercepted or shot at, and so that was good. So occasionally, and of course, there were some of the families were in Jerusalem at the time. There was accommodation there for the families, and some of our families were there. And so, you know, we used to get together and go down to the coast and have a swim and so on, and come back again. Otherwise, we'd look for somewhere to eat most of the time, as most 19, 20-year-olds did. And we didn't drink too much, I don't think, although gin was pennies, old pennies, very, very cheap. And occasionally, I suppose, we probably got stuck into a little bit too much drink, but, you know, it was not a regular thing. And but the rest of the time was this sort of training, and we used to go out short distances out, again, you know, trying to get the guys used to a bit of map reading and so on, but mainly ourselves. And we were sent off on courses. Yes. They had a Middle East tactical school in Cairo. You know, it was quite a big setup, and there was a Middle East signal school too, because that I was sent to a little bit later on, because they wanted to turn me into the battalion signal officer. So I had to go off to Egypt to the signal school and learn Morse at eight Morse code at 8 words a minute, and how to take a field telephone to pieces.
When you took your platoon out on platoon training, or you were on a company scheme, you mentioned teaching them map reading. What other sorts of things were you practicing on those?
Well, most of it was just marching up through the hills, mainly to keep the guys fit, you know, and stop them getting too bored, give them something to do. I said we always had a lot of the guys on guard duties, you know, on the vehicle parks and on our various billets and, you know, the MI room. And I think we had a guard on the Palestine police station set up there as well.
Were those guards designed as a protection against terrorism, or were they against thieving?
Yes, their rifles were loaded, I think.
Rifles were loaded.
They had, you know, they weren't ceremonial.
I mean, there are two
although
threats,
the, luckily there. they were never tested, I think, which is probably just as well.
And there's a threat of violence, and sometimes also with vehicle compounds.
Well, it was the internal security mindset we were in, if I could use that. Funny word. And so there was always too many people on guard, we reckoned, because, you know, it was... and so you very often, throughout a biggish town, you might have two orderly officers on duty at night time. As I said, an emergency platoon, which was ready with vehicles and armed and with a couple of days' rations or whatever, was the standard pack for them, who were on standby for 24 hours, and we took this in turn, rotations.
When you were on standby, what was your warning time?
Well, we were almost instantaneously ready. I mean, they usually gather us into one location in the town, and the vehicles were there and whatever, you know, water, because it was beginning to get hot by this time. March, April in Palestine.
So how long would it have taken you to be in the vehicles and moving then if you'd been crashed out?
Oh, minutes.
Minutes.
Well, it depends. I mean, during the daytime, the guys were sort of up and about, you know, and handy, and we could have been moving within a very short time. Nighttime, I suppose one would have had to... We didn't sort of sleep dressed or anything like that. It was never regarded quite as such a huge emergency that one would have to deal with, because... Palestine was quiet at the time, and one didn't need to have a sort of stand to all night or anything like that.
What was your accommodation like?
Well, we were in stone buildings with tile floors. A bit chilly when we first got there in February. The officers had a room of their own, and the troops were sort of bundled in, you know, depending on the size of the room, 20 or 30 to a room. They're all undercover, all right.
Were these actual barracks?
No. They were requisitioned buildings in the town. I can't remember what they were. They might have been sort of bits of sort of hostelries, hotels, and I suppose, because there were plenty of Arabs in the town. I mean, the schools were still there, and I mean, there was a very big factory that made soap from olive oil. It was the main. Of course, it was nothing like Nablus is today, which, of course, is a huge mini city, really. It was quite a small town at the time. Population, oh gosh, what can one say? An Arab town, perhaps a couple of thousand or something like that.
Did you have anything to do with them, with the local?
No, not very much. I mean, we made polite noises to the mayor or the head man of the town, but that was mainly through the sort of seer and the adjutant. And used to go and, with an interpreter, go and used to chew things over with him about what his problems were, and, you know, just liaison generally. But I don't remember having any direct contact with the guys in the town at all. But they were all amongst us. I mean, you know, the one trouble was that early morning was trying to not getting woken up by donkeys going eeyore outside your window, which was a piercing noise, which we used to grumble about a lot.
What about the call to prayer? Did that come out early?
Well, yes, that must have been happening, of course. There must have been mosques in the town. There were nothing. I was very much on the rim of the town with my companies. I don't remember that there particularly, but I remembered it in other places. They hadn't got loudspeakers the way they have today. The muezzin, who used to get up on the top of the minarets and at dawn or most other times and let fly. Nowadays, of course, they've all got loud hailers like Victoria Station, where they can tell you all about it, and Allah is great, and Muhammad is his prophet, and what have you. They were all right. We got on all right with them, you know, just passing them in the street and so on. They didn't treat us as anything like a menace at all, and they got used to us, the ordinary guy pushing his donkey cart along and that sort of thing. And there was no sort of antagonism of any kind that I could remember at all. But I'm sure it wasn't there, otherwise I think I would have remembered it.
When you went on your tactics course, Middle East tactics course, can you remember what you learned there?
not much, I think, possibly. We used to go out into the desert, you know, it was only about a 2 or 3 week course. Again, we used to be lectured vigorously about this, that, and the sort of tactics that were needed in the desert, because we had not much experience of desert in Palestine, oddly enough. None of us were stationed down in the Negev desert at the time. We were all up in these hill stations mainly, or down on the coastal plain, which was agricultural almost entirely, as it is today, I presume. And so we had to learn about desert warfare and desert tactics, merely from a sort of platoon commander's point of view or a company commander's point of view, nothing massive. It wasn't the staff college stuff at all.
Do you remember anything struck you as being particularly distinctive about that, about the style of tactics in the desert?
Well, it was mainly patrolling, you know, camouflage, how to lay out a platoon position for sort of defensive purposes. Some night patrolling we used to do. Try and get ourselves not too terribly lost with a compass and so on. Remember to take your steel helmet off when you had a look at your compass, otherwise it pointed you in another direction. Something else I shall mention to you later on, which indeed it must have happened. And it was fairly rudimentary stuff. And there'd been no battle experience amongst the instructors at that time. We were sitting out in the desert there looking at the Italians. There were no Germans there. The Afrika Korps hadn't turned up at that time. And Mussolini was making his usual fiery noises, but not doing anything very much there in particular. More in East Africa, of course. He was being a bit troublesome. We had to go and deal with that later on. Not we, but, you know, the British had to.
Did you know much about the Italian army and its weaponry?
Not really, no, customs. no. In fact, we used to get notes come out about Know Your Enemy, but it was all about the Germans that had come out of France. getting to know your enemy and notes from France and things like that used to get circulated to us, but there wasn't really very much to say about our part of the world at that time. Not then, later on undoubtedly there was, but
do you remember what whether in this tactics course there was an emphasis on the offensive or on the defensive or on some other phase of war?
Frankly, I can't remember particularly, no, but it was merely platoon tactics, and presumably went more or less through the gambit, you know, how to lay out a platoon, set up and dig yourself in, and on reverse slopes, hopefully. And no doubt we mainly we did toots, you know.
But when you were doing this digging in for platoons,
we didn't have any demonstration troops with us at the school.
But you dug in yourself, presumably.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Were you digging one man slit trenches or two man slit trenches?
Oh, there'd have been almost invariably two man or even three man slit trenches. Mm. Yes, if you could dig at all. Some of that desert was damned hard. Mm. 2 inches underneath the sand, you hit rock, which I will mention again later on.
Was there any particular style of layout for a platoon position?
That I can remember, no. I mean, you had your sort of three section locations and a platoon headquarters sort of thing, but the platoon headquarters was only you and a couple of other guys, you know. Mm. One's Batman, one had in those days, and maybe the odd signaller, although signalling equipment was pretty useless anyway. If it was more static, of course, one perhaps had a landline laid from battalion or from company headquarters, but probably not.
And the other course you mentioned was signals course. And
yes, I'll tell you about that a bit later on, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you've done this basic tactical course in the desert. Did anything you learned there follow on naturally from what you've been doing at the Octo or in the Artists, or did it like this being different?
It was map reading, and you know, we used to go out into the desert and we'd do one of these tactical exercises without troops, you know. We'd given a sort of situation, enemy over there and something over here and no guns and whatever, and you're here and now your job is to do this. And, you know, think about it and talk of it amongst yourselves. And then in a few minutes I shall ask you what your plan is and how you were going to issue your orders to your section commanders. I mean, very often at the tactical school one finds oneself as a sort of quasi-company commander.
Yes.
Naturally. And so we learned to, you know, do a prize a situation, if you like, to
appreciate
that's appreciation. Mm-hmm. And then we learnt the sort of standard way of giving our orders to our lower commanders, be it your section commanders or whatever, and you know, appreciation, information, method, whatever, so on and so forth, like whatever it used to be, and you know, all a routine really it was. And I don't even remember ever having used it, but that's something else again. But you know, you say you start times and that sort of thing, and coordinating of old wind-up watches. We had nothing like today's watches. Synchronizing watches, yes, yeah. That's right. I can't even remember the terms now. So that's what we did. I can't remember. I suppose they might have taken us from the tactical school. They might have taken us off somewhere where we could see what a 3-inch mortar looks like. I don't think we'd got them in the battalion at that time. There were probably only half a dozen in the whole of the Middle East at that time.
When you were doing these things.
And no doubt they took us around. The gunners had a school, and no doubt they took us around to show us some 25-pounders. And what they could do, although they'd only fire off one round because they were so short of ammunition.
I was going to ask if in this training you introduced the idea of support from other arms, such as the artillery, armour, and the air. Did you have...
Not much air. A, there wasn't much air, and I don't think we ever saw very much of it in training. Are we running out?
No.
And... But we must have been taken around to have a look at one of the old I tanks, which was supposed to be supporting us. And I'll ask a little more about that later on as well, in real time, if I can put it that way. And I don't remember too much about having been taught an awful lot, to be quite honest. But I think it was the training was fairly rudimentary. There was very little battle experience, or none at all, really, as far as I know, in the Middle East. And so they hadn't got an awful lot to tell us other than the rudimentary textbook things about, you know, how to move a platoon about, and how to, and the its various functions, sort of digging it in, and, you know, as I say, toots, lots of toots, yes, all over the place. And I suppose one's capacity to lead was assessed on that by people who really had not much idea about how to do it themselves anyway. But in retrospect, impressed. They were majors, and yeah. I was still only 20, and still only a second lieutenant.
you did your tactics course, and you were doing some basic training with
the battalion, yes.
In
and that was about it, you see. I mean, yes, when we went up, sometimes we'd go off on two or three days up into the hills in Palestine. Yes. We'd sleep out for the night and knock our boots out in the morning, make certain there wasn't a scorpion lying inside it. That sort of thing.
Were you able to do any shooting? Was there any range work possible?
Very little. Again, ammunition was terribly short. And from that sort of training, I suppose the troops did. Of course, we had three-eight revolvers, officers. You weren't allowed to have a rifle, not till later. More about that later.
Did you regard your 3-8 revolver as being a lethal weapon?
No, not really. Anyway, we had to, wherever we went in Palestine, we had to carry it. Anyhow, again, that was the internal security thing. If we went round to the local hotel to have a drink in the bar, if there was such a thing, or going down to Jaffa to have a swim, you always had a sidearm with you. We used to buy these little .22 Berettas because they were more comfortable to carry around, yes, than a clumping old .38. Smith & Wesson revolver, and we could wear it underneath our sort of we wore bush jackets and shorts in those days, of course, and you could wear it underneath the sort of skirt of a bush jacket, and it didn't look too ridiculous when you walked into a bar to have a drink somewhere or a restaurant in Tel Aviv to have a meal. But no, they were no. I don't think they were any use, except at about two feet range. Apart from that, I don't think they were much good. They were right if you hit anything, but they weren't very accurate. Or
did you stay in Nablus all the time, or were you?
No. We were in Nablus. How am I doing? We were in Nablus for about two months,
yes,
or so. 3 months, from about February to May, and in May we went to Jerusalem, and we took over Allenby Barracks there, which was the garrison barracks from the Second Black Watch, with whom we were to have much to do later on, but more of that later. They went down to the desert, and they were involved in the first desert push, Wavell's push, as it was called, about as far as Mirza Matruh and no further. But we took that over, and again we had half the battalion on guard every night or on an emergency duty. There was a government house because there was a governor there during the British Mandate time. There was a force headquarters, so that needed a guard. In fact, they needed an officer guard on government house. There were a couple, at least two military hospitals there, which had to have some sort of guard on them. And the emergency platoon, and with guys away on courses a lot, as they were down at the tactical school, and some went off on small arms courses. There were very few subalterns left, and we found ourselves on duty every other night, if not more so, the subalterns, which didn't amuse us at all. So we didn't get out and about too much when we were there. A lot of it was on Otherwise, we did training mainly in barracks, and we really couldn't do much else.
How many subalterns were there in A Company then?
Well, when I first got there, we had there was a company commander, a second in command of the company, and two officers and a PSM, a platoon sergeant major, which was a strange animal which didn't last very long during World War II. They were mainly CSMs who'd been put into somewhere half between being a warrant officer and a commander.